so much in store for you tonight, dear listener. Not only do we have Mr. Leather Daddy Boy, Jorge Vietto, whose awesomeness knows no bounds and healthy boundaries. He is an outreach activist for HIV and hepatitis. And you do testing in tattoo shops in the Castro, which I think is very cool. And he's on the Hepatitis C Task Force here in San Francisco because it's such a huge issue in San Francisco.
It sure is.
We also will have Maxine Holloway from Femina Potens. She's got an Art of Restraint coming up. And we're also going to talk to Andrew Sullivan, who made the porn An Open Invitation, a real swingers party that was filmed at the Armory at a real swingers party. So we're going to talk to him about how a porn can be an open invitation to the viewer to explore sexual freedom. We like sexual freedom. And my token straight guy,
that would
the
be
rock
me.
And roll nurse.
Yes.
Hey, how's your show going?
It's going well, I guess. I don't know.
Backspins here on FCC Free Radio.
I don't know if there are any listeners, but I'm enjoying it.
Yeah, well, that's important. That's the important part. So, Jorge, next month is Hepatitis Month.
That is correct. It is National Hepatitis Month.
And it's a huge problem in San Francisco because this is the place where it kills the most people or something like that. I mean, San Francisco has a huge hepatitis C problem, more so than any other city in the United States, actually.
It is. In fact, it looks like it's 12,000 folks in San Francisco are living with hep C currently right now.
It's an incredibly hardy virus. A lot of people, you know, we went through the whole HIV scare and, you know, maybe everyone got tested for HIV, but they weren't even testing for hepatitis even as much as 10 years ago, many times because I guess they thought that they didn't have a cure.
That is correct. When in fact, we're finding out these days that a number of folks are clearing the virus on their own. Mm-hmm. And of course, there have been improvements and
different
therapy.
Kinds of treatments. They have an interferon treatment that can actually clear the virus. You know, I guess it's something like
I think about 30%.
Wow, but interferon is
about 30%.
That's kind of rough.
Oh, is it 30%?
Side effects big time.
Right.
Yeah.
But if it works, that's awesome because then you don't have to live with.
What are some of the things you can recommend for people? I mean, because it's not something that you ordinarily would get tested for if you go to the gynecologist and ask for test me for everything. They only test you for chlamydia, gonorrhea, and HIV and syphilis.
One of the things we're trying to advocate for, specifically with the Hepatitis C Task Force, is that everybody should get tested for hepatitis C. And in fact, we encourage everybody to ask their primary care physician for a hepatitis C test, regardless of whether you will engage in intravenous drug use or not.
Well, there's other ways of getting it other than just intravenous drug use.
Absolutely,
isn't that right?
Absolutely. We're finding out recently that hepatitis C can be transmitted in a number of ways. You know, it could be through anal sex, it could be through vaginal sex, it could be through even sharing needles, works, or if you snort cocaine and you're sharing that with your friends, you
sharing
can get it through
the straw.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I heard also that you can get it through personal care items. It's any blood-to-blood contact, basically, but you could also get it tearing your gums when you're brushing your teeth and sharing a toothbrush.
That is correct.
You know, any kind of microscopic tear that you wouldn't really notice, just any tiny little particle of blood, or even sharing like toenail clippers.
Right, which is a little bit more something that we need to keep in the forefront of our minds because, as we all know, hepatitis C is certainly a lot more virulent than HIV.
Mm-hmm.
So
it lives easier for longer. Like it can live up to 2 weeks in just a dry drop of blood.
Yeah, there's
2 weeks.
Crazy.
Mm-hmm, really. And right now, I think there's a lot of stigma with hepatitis that it's only something that junkies get, but it is possible for other people to get it. And it really is important for all of us. I mean, many people live with hepatitis C without even knowing it.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because one of the populations that we want to, like I said, we want everybody to get tested for hepatitis C, but the baby boomer generation is one of those subpopulations of the population where we're encouraging to get tested. There was a lot of stuff going on in the 60s that, well, I wasn't around in the 60s, but from what I hear, it might have put
people
you at risk
for
hepatitis.
People were having some parties.
Yeah. Right. That's what I hear.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
I was a twinkle in my daddy's eye.
Totally. Exactly.
Well, in the hospital, I see it quite commonly, patients that have HIV and hep C together, and that is a really horrible double whammy. But it seems like if it's caught early and people take care of both of those conditions, both of them can be livable.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really awful when they come and
well, because
together.
HIV and hepatitis kind of can work together to diminish your health. And a
in
lot of the
ways.
AIDS medications go through the liver. And if your immune system is damaged, you're not going to be as able to fight off the hepatitis. And so a lot of people with HIV, I have been hearing, can pass away from liver cancer, which is, you know, one of the late stages of hepatitis C.
Absolutely. And obviously, you, doctor, can talk about this.
Nurse, sorry.
You can talk
rock
about
and roll nurse
as well. But certainly being co-infected with both HIV and hepatitis C can definitely be one of those things where it can definitely put you in a tight spot.
Right.
You know, sometimes a decision has to be made whether you want the hepatitis needs to be treated first or the HIV has to be treated first. And it's all going to depend on a lot of different numbers and the person's overall health.
Right. But even if you're not treating in an aggressive way with something like interferons, there are a lot of ways that you can treat hepatitis C in a more holistic approach, in a more natural approach. Like you can just give up drinking, start taking milk thistle, you know, really start trying to take care of your liver as much as you can, reduce your stress, get some acupuncture.
Yeah, qigong. Absolutely. Yeah, good liver health really makes a huge, huge difference. And
right.
Unfortunately, a lot of people don't know that and they just continue behaviors that are going to make the hep C worse when they don't realize that they could change a few behaviors and really, really change their health.
Right, and your liver is so important.
Absolutely, and you know, we're throwing the word hepatitis around, and
maybe we haven't defined
we
it.
We should probably mention that hepatitis means inflammation of the liver.
Right.
So whether it's viral or caused by a different
drinking,
by drinking or
mushrooms or Tylenol.
Mushrooms, interesting. Tell me
psilocybin.
More.
If you take the psychedelic mushrooms and you take too much, if you get toxicity from taking mushrooms, it would take a lot of mushrooms for you to kill yourself. But mushrooms are liver toxic. They go right to your liver.
That's a bad trip.
And if you feel, exactly. And so you're all like strung out and you're liver toxic, it's no fun.
Oof.
Take that milk thistle, kids. It's good for your liver. Silymarin. Yum. Yeah, so that's some of the harm reduction stuff that I want to talk to you about, because I know that you do testing and outreach, and then you also do harm reduction with special populations, people who are at risk for HIV and hepatitis. And you also, you know, go out there and have fun yourself in these communities.
Yeah, so I work for the Stop AIDS Project, and my position title there is a network coordinator for the Leather and Kink Network. So basically, I get paid to be kinky.
Hey.
So, and what that involves, I should probably explain. Not only does it, I know, right? It does involve a lot of testing, a lot of counseling, a lot of referral to services.
Sure.
But we also do a lot of workshops. Mm-hmm. So we demonstrate a lot of safer BDSM behavior.
Mm-hmm.
We also model a lot of negotiation, and within that negotiation comes in talking about HIV and hep C status and when you were last tested. And that may change how you play.
I think that's really important, because that way you're not like looking down on someone. Like you're not the special white coat doctor saying, I have perfect health and I'm at no risk for this and I'm judging you for even needing to be tested. Do you know what I mean? I think it puts a lot of people in kind of an uncomfortable situation where they don't feel comfortable talking about their risks, or they don't ask for testing. You know, and that way, if you're coming from a place of like, hey, I'm kinky, it's totally okay to be kinky, here's how to make being kinky safe.
We talk a lot about harm reduction when it comes to blood contact, whether it's using needles or not. When, you know, there's hooking rituals, there's flogging, there's whipping, fisting. A lot of these can put us in contact with blood.
Right.
You know, one thing I do
single
have
tails.
To say. Single tails, absolutely, yes. Now, one of the things that I should mention is that most of the responsible players will definitely not shy away if you disclose to them that you have hepatitis C. Most safe BDSM players out there use universal precautions, meaning wearing gloves and you know, cleaning equipment and not reusing needles, so on and so forth.
Right. Well, I could see how important that would be. But also, I mean, if you're in an industry like kink porn, I know that in their protocol for AIM testing, I don't think that hepatitis C is included in those tests. those little stingers on the single tail whips, like those obviously draw blood. And if the hepatitis virus can live on there for 2 weeks, you'd want to make sure that those things were cleaned thoroughly.
Yeah. So there's two things to look at that. I'm glad you mentioned that. Blood can be also become airborne. What's the word I'm looking for? Become
droplets?
Yes, droplets in the air.
Right.
So that
and
could
microscopic
be
microscopic droplets.
Yeah, and you can actually breathe those in.
So it is theoretically possible. You're having a really bloody scene, particularly in close quarters, that you could make that a risk as well.
It would be pretty hard to contact.
Like, you would have to have a sore in your mouth or something? Because don't you need, like, blood to blood?
Right. Well,
it has to get in the bloodstream.
In the bloodstream,
basically.
But right. if you're inhaling it, it's going into your lungs, and your lungs
could be the lungs or the stomach, impossibly. But all when it hits the stomach, it hits a lot of acid and stuff.
Sure.
So that's a little more protection than the lungs would have.
Oh, that's a really good point.
Definitely within the stomach, the Hep C virus would not survive.
Right, because you would have the digestive.
Stuff. Within your mouth, that might be a different thing. Mm-hmm. I do know that with the HIV virus. I know that, you know, we do start digesting our food as soon as we put it in our mouths.
Mm-hmm. Right, you know, the alpha amylase, exactly.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So those enzymes will break down the protein. Well, the protein coating that protects the virus.
Oh, really?
So
great.
With HIV, it can definitely be a hostile environment.
Mm-hmm.
For Hep C, I think that might be a little bit of a different story.
Because it's such a hardy virus.
It's a lot hardier than HIV.
Right. And there's three different kinds of hepatitis.
Yes, thank you. The alphabet soup here.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, and there's actually five different kinds of hepatitis.
Yeah,
there's
they've expanded
through
it.
Through F now, A, B, C, D, E, and F. But the ones that we usually worry about are A, B, and C. Isn't that right?
That's correct.
Sure.
And do you want to break it down? Ask Booty Cooker.
Gosh, you know, it's been a while since I was in nursing school, so I might come up with some.
I'm in a class right now, so I can.
As best I remember, hepatitis B can be sexually transmitted,
right?
As well.
Uh-huh.
as C. But we have better ways of treating hepatitis B, and, you know, quote unquote, mm-hmm. curing mm-hmm. hepatitis B with different pharmaceuticals. And Hep C, there is interferon, but it's still kind of
although I do
iffy.
Know people who have cleared the virus.
Yeah, it can happen just like with HIV. It can happen spontaneously with no particular explanation.
Although I think there's a percent that can clear hepatitis C.
Not as much with HIV.
Yeah, so I mean, we're talking about long-term non-progressors with folks with HIV. With Hep C, I think it's a little bit different. There is, and I'm going to refrain from giving you a percentage, but there is, and you're right, Monica, there is a certain percentage of folks who have been known to clear the virus on their own.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the case with HIV. Once you become HIV positive, you're
right. You're not able to clear the virus.
Right.
What's more with HIV is that the symptoms can reverse themselves. If that makes any sense. I mean, the T cell count can go
back up and down,
back to normal levels.
You can heal your liver
uh-huh.
with good
again,
liver.
You know, if we go back practices. To the, you know, cutting down on drinking, you know, don't do the 2-for-1 mm-hmm. cocktails.
Oh, no, 2-for-1 cocktails. Although it's probably saves you money as well.
So B is not transmitted, to the best of my knowledge. I've not heard of B being transmitted through IV drug use, but could it be?
Theoretically, it can.
Okay.
The most common way I've heard of Hep B being transmitted is through contaminated food with fecal.
I thought that was hepatitis A.
Or is that A?
That's A.
Yeah, that's
yeah,
A.
Yeah, right. I was going to say eating dirty
A
butt. One of them is eating dirty butt. That's all
right.
I know.
That's why it's so it goes ass, booty, and cooker.
That's
hepatitis
right,
A
yeah.
is ass.
Right.
Hepatitis B is booty. You get it sexually transmitted. And the hepatitis C is with the cooker when you're cooking up your heroin to shoot it in.
Of course. I hope, I hope my coworkers are not listening.
No but, worries. Your secret is safe with us.
But there's overlap.
But it's a confusing thing because there are so many different kinds of hepatitis, and they're completely different viruses. It's not like they're related to each other.
Correct.
Right, right. And with hepatitis A and B, there is a vaccine.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. You can get vaccinated for both of them at the same time and just be like, all right.
That's right.
And when you travel outside of the U.S., mm-hmm. usually that's highly recommended
mm-hmm.
because especially for hepatitis A, You don't know what kind of crazy eating situations you're going to be in certain countries.
Yeah.
And there might have been some booty involved in that.
That's right. That's right. Now, I'm glad you mentioned the travel. And you might want to think about getting vaccinated for Hep A and B way before you go on your trip. This is right. A series of three shots.
Mm-hmm.
And they are done over a period of 3 months, I believe, or 6 months?
Five months.
Okay. So, but it is a series of three shots. So you're not immunized with your first shot necessarily.
Interesting. As you are in the kink world and doing this kind of outreach, I imagine, well, you have like a bajillion friends on Facebook and you're really well known in the kink community and everyone loves you because you're so lovable.
I'm tossing my hair.
He's wearing like these little lamb chop beards, so he's tossing that, right? Hey. I imagine that you've really gotten to connect and really help people who are, you know, they're getting maybe a diagnosis or some test results, and you've been really able to, you know, help give them helpful information that has made their life better.
Yeah, right now, some of the stuff that I've been coming across is there's been a lot of misinformation out there regarding hepatitis C, even within the leather and kink community. So there's been a lot of rallying around, let's go ahead and educate ourselves. Right. Around how this is in fact transmitted and are we at risk and what do we need to do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been really neat. You know, at Stop AIDS, I have a community advisory board that helps not only come up with some of the programming decisions that we do for our network, but also went to the Hep C Task Force and spoke
at the city of San Francisco level.
That's right. So we had Gage Strongarm, who is one of the San Francisco Leather Daddies, one of our first openly trans men to be San Francisco Leather Daddy.
Mm-hmm.
And he owns a tattoo shop. So, you know, he talked about the queer, lesbian, and also the tattooing community and how that would be affected as well. And we also had a long member of the 15 Association,
right.
Steve Gaines. And they both had very, very good concerns about hepatitis C. And so it was really nice to have the community advisory board members say, hey, you know what? We have misinformation. And we are supposed to be the ones that know. People are sort of, you know, looking up to us. So mm-hmm. we need to get the facts.
Yeah. Well, especially with tattooing, I mean, not only do you have to be careful that you're not sharing needles, but you also have to not share the ink pots. And so when you go to get a tattoo, I mean, is that something that's illegal to share ink pots and needles now? Are there protections against that or...
Yeah, the Department of Public Health would probably cringe or shut you down.
Right. Well, yeah.
If they find out that you're sharing needles or mm-hmm. not autoclaving. Mm-hmm. Actually, in fact, most needles either get autoclaved or are disposable. So,
So autoclaving is high heat cleaning.
Right.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you for breaking that down for us.
So, and that breaks down the viruses.
Right.
And it's a little bit harder than your dishwasher. We should probably mention
that. Yeah, a lot.
So you can't just put your needles in the dishwasher.
No.
You can put your dildos in your dishwasher.
You can. I love that. You can put your silicone dildos in the dishwasher. Dishwasher safe.
Now, do you mind if I...
Please.
I wanted to actually expand a little bit on what I was saying earlier. One of the things that we're looking at is what cleaning agents actually kill Hep C. That's been one of those points of confusion out there. We used to believe that a solution of 10% bleach to
right?
water would kill most of everything, but we're finding out it probably doesn't kill hepatitis C. So we're looking at other products like Cavicide, Medicide, and particularly Cavicide because it comes in wipes.
Right.
And it also comes in a spray form, which
is
really
the
great.
Rapicide or something? Rapid Rapicide? Or is it Cavicide?
Cavicide,
okay.
Medicide, and Wavicide are the three sides that I'm aware of.
Okay.
There is a new rapid hepatitis C test that has come out by...
Oh, is it the Aura?
Aura Quick.
Quick,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
so
it just got approved.
Oh, interesting. And are you seeing it yet, or is it something that's down the pipeline?
I saw a sample.
Yeah.
No, you know what? We're looking to get more awareness about it, A,
right.
And B, maybe get more funding around. I mean, these tests are around $25 a piece.
Is that cheap? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That's a really good deal.
Pretty good. Yeah, that
seems okay.
Yeah,
I'd be willing to pop up $25.
And don't quote me on that price, but we did have one of the reps from Orisher
mm-hmm.
come and talk to us and talk to us about the test. And it's very much just like an HIV test.
Mm.
It's the same thing. You know, you swab the inside
of your mouth.
That is exactly right. You swab the inside of your mouth, and it takes some of the cells inside of your cheek and.
And really easy and non-invasive.
Yeah, Yana. Nice. And generally, it takes about 20 minutes.
Cool.
And cool. How reliable is that? That could be something. If there were false positives, then
it's a good question.
That would be pretty tragic.
Yeah,
that you have Hep C when you
well,
really
just
don't.
Just because you have the
or
Hep
false
C
negatives.
Antibodies doesn't
right.
mean
that
you have hepatitis C.
Right, right.
That's true.
That is very, very true. Now, yeah, I mean with HIV, if you have antibodies, then
right.
you have HIV.
Right, exactly.
And with Hep C, you
have
you
to have another test.
Yeah, exactly. Now, but it's still going to work very similar. It's still going to be, you were wondering about the accuracy on it, and the representatives from OraSure assure us that it's pretty accurate, if not just as accurate as the HIV test.
Right. The other HCV antibody test also tests for antibodies. And so if you have a positive result on hepatitis C antibodies, it means that at one point you have hepatitis mm-hmm, C, mm-hmm. developed antibodies, and you may or may not have cleared the virus.
Exactly. In which case, most doctors or clinics will go ahead and perform a confirmatory draw.
Right, which means that you get a blood test and that checks your viral load, which is a more expensive
exactly,
test.
Exactly, exactly. So most of the tests that we see out there, particularly with HIV, the rapid tests are, like you mentioned, they look for a body's response to the virus, mm-hmm. the antibodies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, again, in order to get it, that's... one of them is a diagnostic test, and one of them is more of a screening test.
Oh.
So the rapid test is more of a screening test, and then the other one is meant to be more of a diagnostic test. Is that
I
right?
See.
I think that's right. I don't know. You guys are going beyond what I know because I actually on the hospital floors we don't really do a lot of this testing, or if we did testing, we would do a blood draw automatically.
Do you mind if I ask you a question real quick?
Mm-hmm, sure.
You mentioned that there's not a whole lot of Hep C testing happening in the hospital.
No, there is a fair amount of it, actually, but okay. it's targeted at certain populations, and it basically, if a doctor thinks that there's some reason that this person might have Hep C, based on probably right. an interview. And talking about behaviors and that sort of thing,
right.
then they'll order a blood test. And
right.
the thing is, in the hospital, as a patient, you're getting blood taken all the time, usually on a daily basis, sometimes more than once a day.
Is there a consent issue?
Oh,
with
yeah.
getting,
okay. Yeah, absolutely.
So you would have to give consent.
Yes, correct, yeah. For HIV testing, for...
Is that the same with hepatitis? Do you know?
You know, actually, I know for HIV... Mm-hmm. I would assume for Hep C, it's never
there might
come
be implied
up.
Consent. I mean, if you go into the hospital
if you got checked in from a
car accident or something, then you're probably and you're unconscious and you're probably giving implied consent.
That mm-hmm. that's probably true. I know that with urine toxicity or Utox is where they're checking for drug use.
Oh, mm-hmm.
they don't necessarily have to get a consent. It doesn't ever have to. Come to the knowledge of the patient.
Okay.
And I'm not sure exactly the legal back and forth about that, but I have seen it where patients didn't know they were being
tested
drugs. That the urine was going for a drug test.
That's
or
weird.
Blood. Yeah, you can test with blood as well. So that's kind of a weird creepy thing actually. I feel a little weird about that.
Right.
Sometimes because
yeah.
sometimes I'm told don't tell the patient what this is for, and,
right.
and I don't know the legalities on that.
Is that ethical or not?
Yeah, is it, I don't.
That's a
good
question.
I don't
feel ethical about.
Yeah.
I don't feel like it's good as far as ethics goes. But that's something I should probably look into. Actually, it's only happened maybe once in years of practice that something like that has happened. But
right.
I guess one of the things that I would like to see changed would be to have doctors and other primary care physicians look into testing everybody. I know that, again, it's not
and
cheap.
And veterans.
You know, veterans.
There's a huge issue with
baby boomers, mm-hmm. You know, teens. I mean, everybody.
Before hepatitis C was even known about as a disease. I think it was in mid-90s that they even discovered it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's impossible for people to get and just be like
yeah,
fully normal people, using finger quotes on normal, totally don't feel judged.
In the hospital, we're testing for TB on pretty much everybody.
Mm-hmm. Tuberculosis.
Yeah, tuberculosis. So because there's been such a revival of tuberculosis, it had died down for a long time, and now it's coming back, and it's really unfortunate because it seems to me like it's one of those diseases we could have gotten rid of, like smallpox, but.
Yeah, I mean, there was a certain amount of deaths even here in San Francisco. I know one of the bartenders and, I believe, owners of Daddy's, or 440 in the Castro.
Oh, really?
One of the bartenders, unfortunately, lost his battle.
Well, that's sad.
Wow.
Yeah, it's funny because you think about, you know, STIs and how much work we could do with the information that we do have, and... You know, with just a little bit more research, which is why I love San Francisco, because they do have something like the Hepatitis C Task Force, and they are putting resources to getting it, you know, out there and, like, destigmatizing. Because I especially think with a face like you, you just make it so, like, you're not looking down on anyone. You're like, look, we all have these kinds of experiences, and here's how you can make it safe. And, you know, I think that's really important.
Yeah, normalizing a lot of the experiences that we have are definitely very important. Mm-hmm. And also normalizing the fact that we're asking for the test. I know that there was a certain amount of a learning curve, I'm also using little quotes, when we first discovered a way to test for HIV. Getting folks to get tested for HIV was a little bit of a challenge. So obviously we're talking about two very completely different diseases, but you know, we're probably going to be facing a little bit of that same curve as well.
Right.
I think there's some people worry about stigma associated with having Hep C. Actually, people that I know that I've run into who are Hep C positive come out and just blurt it out. I was a little shocked about that. I was a little surprised, like, is this something you really want to be talking about right now, or are you telling me?
Well,
or?
Sometimes it's nice to get it off your chest, and especially if you know that real people, normal people can get it. I think it's nice when you can self-disclose if you feel comfortable doing that.
Yeah. I'm glad you said if you feel comfortable. I mean, I definitely think that disclosing is certainly up to the individual. Mm-hmm. And if it's the right situation,
right.
If it's right for them, if they feel safe.
You don't want to disclose to someone who isn't nice or doesn't care or doesn't need to know.
We can say that. That's true. We can say that. But I was at a bar in Vallejo 2 weeks ago, and I disclosed my HIV positive status to somebody I had just met.
You're so cool.
Thank you. But apparently I freaked them out.
Really?
Yeah.
But I was just like, oh, you know, he was talking about something or other. And I said, well, you know, I'm taking this medication. I'm taking a triplet from HIV. You know, it's not a walk in the park, this and that.
Right.
And apparently I didn't notice it, but the guy kind of went white and just...
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's unfortunate, but it shows that there is still a lot of stigma and there's still a lot of...
Well, and I think there's sadness.
Lack of knowledge,
you know,
and ignorance.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you know what you were mentioning about, you know, quote-unquote normal people, you know, and I chuckle because when Gavin, our mayor at the time, Mr. Gavin Newsom, appointed us, it was about 30 of us for the Hep C Task Force. And I looked around in the room and during our first meeting, and to look around and to see all the different faces.
Right.
I, of course, was making an assumption about what faces I was going to see in the room.
Oh, sure.
And then I look to my left and I look to my right, and there's these two ladies who look like, I mean, one of them's a school teacher.
Normal. Right.
They look normal, right, you know. Right. One of them's a grandmother and, you know, never did drugs.
Right.
Never did drugs. But she found out about 10 years ago that she probably acquired hepatitis C sometime in the 60s or 70s.
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All it takes is blood-to-blood contact. So, you know, and it's funny because I never thought sharing a toothbrush would ever be a big deal. But when you have a virus as hardy as hepatitis C, that's why it's so important to just get tested, you know, and don't, like, take it on as, like, this huge, like, oh, I'm a bad person because I, you know, have this germ. I mean, germs are just opportunists, you know.
Well, that's the thing, too, is that it your life doesn't end if you have Hep C. And I've seen that with my friends who are Hep C positive. Their life goes on. They're having lots of sex, but it's safe, really safe sex. And that's the cool thing, is that they're upfront and they've looked into it and they've researched and they know how to make things safe for themselves and for others. If you get past the stigma, you can get to this point where it becomes something that's livable and workable, and it's just It's just a part of your life, and it's not something horrible.
Right. And as I often like to put a rosy shine on things, you can actually use infection as a way of, like, really transforming your life and seeing, wow, I really need to do something positive with myself, or this is my rock bottom moment. And then you can use it as a way of, you know, rallying the community, you know, seeing, oh, this, there is a need for work and outreach, and I can do something. And really sometimes can't, I mean, I'm not saying it, I would prefer there be a cure and that it just isn't an issue. But it does, you know, some people can take positives away from something bad happening to them.
I'm glad you said that. Because even for folks who get an HIV diagnosis, mm-hmm. I'm not saying, I am by no means minimizing having what it means to have hepatitis C or HIV. Like I said, I myself am living with HIV. But living with Hep C or HIV these days is certainly a lot more different than it was,
right.
You know, 10, right. 20, 30 years ago.
The drugs are better. People are, you know, having more relatively normal, healthy lives, whatever normal means to you. Hey.
Right.
And there's more knowledge and less fear.
Yeah. Let's That's talk about thing. Piercing.
Let's talk about piercing.
You want to talk about piercing? Because I piercing. Love talking about piercing. And what I didn't know until Mark from Janus put three needles in my arm was that I love piercing.
Is this Mark from Mark and Pilar?
Yes, exactly. Aren't they great?
I heart them.
Yes. Mark and Pilar of Janus, we heart you. Okay, so at the bondage dinner, Mark put three needles in my arm. One of them was a kind of a bigger one, and then two were little ones. And it was like having a glass of champagne all at the same time. And I'm like trying to do a live radio interview, and suddenly I'm like, everything's pretty. This is awesome. What was I talking about?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, that, you know, those, that physical reaction, you know,
right.
your endorphins and,
yeah.
and all kinds of stuff kind of kicking in are just
right.
such a wonderful natural high.
Right. And Mark from Janus, he's an sex educator and, you know, a kink aware hepatitis C educator, you know, and he of course made me feel super safe because he's got his black latex gloves on and he's wearing his like harness and he puts his reading glasses on and he's so cute, you know, he's so cute. And like he tells me about all the harm reduction stuff and these are the first time that these needles have been used and then he's going to put the rubber end on it, and you know, it was just so great.
I love working with them.
Yeah.
I had a chance to do a similar scene with Mark and Pilar
right.
last year, where we put about 10 rings on each arm.
Wow.
And then we,
so you pierced 10 little, or actually 20, because there's two holes per piercing.
Right. Two
right?
exit, two entry
out.
Point and exit point. Right.
Okay. So, and through these rings?
Correct. And then we laced them up, and they had this contraption that they made with like PVC and shower curtain rings. and, you know, and it sounds like one of these like really
crafting.
Kinky Home Depot sort of like.
You mean Dom Depot?
Dom Depot, exactly. But it was great. And like you were mentioning, Mark and Pilar are really both very good examples
yeah.
of what harm reduction can look like.
They explain harm reduction.
Fun harm reduction,
yeah.
because while they're very serious about the their craft,
right.
They joke around, but they also explain everything from
right.
beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm putting gloves on now. I'm going
right.
to go and take them off now. I'm going to go and re-glove when I go ahead and take these off. I'm going to go and put corks on your, you know, at the end
exactly.
of your
mm-hmm.
your
so you don't stab yourself or anyone else.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So
which is
they're
nice.
Great.
Yeah. And Pilar did a corset out of needles, like in her back. She had like a V of needles in her skin, and then she laced a ribbon in between the different needles, just lacing it up as if, I mean, she had a bare back and then was kind of wearing a corset just on her skin. It was very interesting and really made people be like, oh. And some people were like, oh, that's so cool. And some people were like, oh, that's so gross. It was really very polarizing for people. You know, and it can be very provocative because it's about blood and it's so, you know, kind of sacred, but it has sacred roots.
Yeah. I mean, you know, blood and pain can have such an interesting relationship to how we deal with emotion, fear. I was at a scene last year at Leather Levi Weekend where somebody asked me to do a really heavy whipping scene.
Mm-hmm.
This person was not a pain bottom,
mm-hmm.
but she wanted to reach atonement. She wanted
really?
To stop beating herself up for. She chose not to have a baby about 33 years ago.
Mm.
And she asked me.
And she still felt guilty.
She still felt guilty. And so.
Right. So she wanted to release that.
Yeah. And so the funny thing is that I happen to be 33, and so she wanted me to help and go ahead and close the scene because I would be the same age as her son or daughter would have been.
Right?
Yeah, but not only the emotion, but the blood around it was just opening up things in your body. Can obviously lead to, you know, infection and stuff like that. But you can also, figuratively speaking, use those holes or wounds or openings to let stuff out.
Interesting. So both, like, intentionally and maybe energetically. And certainly a lot of our emotions are stored in our bodies in different places. And it's nice when you can poke them in different ways to get them to move.
Absolutely.
So you're not stuck.
One thing I like to think about... about my skin, I don't know. In the past few years, I always knew this was true, but it never really hit me the same way as recently. That skin is an organ.
Oh yeah,
and just because it's
organ
on the outside doesn't mean it's not an organ, and it doesn't mean that it's not pliable. And you know, we think of skin as like the last defense before evil stuff gets in the body.
Right.
And that is true. The skin is an incredible defensive system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an organ, and it moves and it changes and it's
absorbs in it.
Yeah, and
transmits.
It kind of blows my mind. I don't know. I don't know why it blows my mind, but I try to think of it as like, you know, it's an organ like my stomach or, you know, it's just because it's on the outside doesn't mean that it's not something that's, I don't know, that can change and take abuse and heal and all that stuff.
Yeah. I was having this really interesting conversation with Nicole Daydone of One Taste last week where we talked about people's fingers and how their fingers become sensitized from doing, you know, One Taste does that orgasmic meditation where they like just do the finger on the clit in a particular way. And so like it's this whole meditation around the sensations of a clitoris. But because guys are feeling all this orgasmic energy of women for like 15 minutes on their little finger, their fingers get really super sensitized, right? And so like what I mean when, you know, skin can transmit is not just that it can transmit skin-to-skin contact viruses or whatever, although it can, but what I was saying was that it can transmit energy and sensation and pleasure and heat and, you know, all of those things. So they are receiving all this orgasmic energy through their fingers and then kind of walk around with their fingers kind of up in the air after that because it's so intense.
So if you were walking around with your finger like this, would that be rude?
I think
it's like
in some
walking
countries
around
it
with the
would
hard on.
Be. Yeah, exactly. But maybe you do have a hard on, and that's okay. Maybe you have an index finger hard on, and God bless you for it. Because clearly you were giving someone some pleasure for a long time, which is the only way that your finger would get like that. So amen, brothers and sisters.
And if your finger remains erect for more than 4 hours,
you might want to seek
that or take some Sudafed. I think 50 milligrams of Sudafed will do the trick.
Really? Is that some safer sex harm reduction?
If you happen to have Sudafed, I've been told that it can help. Bring your dick down.
Reverse
engorgement.
Yeah.
Reverse
now,
the Viagra.
Yeah, but thing. I mean, you definitely want to do this like, you know,
hilarious.
You know, 4 hours. You don't want to. You know, I've heard of people, you know, having hard-ons for overnight, and then you actually can create some serious damage to your little friend down there.
Oh no, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
What can happen?
It's called priapism.
Priapism. Priapism. I've heard of that. Priapism. I've heard of that, but I don't know what it is.
It means
hi.
Do you want to talk to us about it, or you're shy? It's okay. We have someone in the studio who is very knowledgeable but shy. Is it called priapism? You can nod your head yes or no. It is called priapism. Okay.
Yay! Do I get a gold star?
And I assume it's painful, too.
Do you know what priapism is, rock and roll nurse?
Not really. Not in terms that I can really talk about.
Interesting. I wonder if it's just like damaging the tissues from over-engorgement. Like from being, you know, having the tissues filled with blood for too long?
You sound so smart.
That sounds right to me. That sounds good for me.
Oh, look, it's Wikipedia. Okay. So, yes. So despite the absence of physical or psychological stimulation, the clitoris or the penis can remain erect for more than 4 hours. And basically, it's a short circuit of the vascular system along the organ. And then, you know, treatment depends on whether or not you have a clitoris or a penis. And it is considered a medical emergency.
Yeah.
And you should see a doctor.
And speaking of doctors, I should probably retract my little recommendation. I am not a doctor.
Oh, right.
So I am not qualified to prescribe
to tell
people what to take.
Right.
I've heard through the grapevine mm-hmm. that Sudafed can help.
Right. And you might want to take that at the 3 hour mark when it's not at the medical emergency point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And if you don't have any Sudafed, you might want to make sure you have some.
Oh, interesting. That is so interesting.
If you're going to, you know, partake in recreational ED drugs.
Right. Well, okay. So there's a lot of different communities and they do a lot of different things. And, you know, I think it's really important not to judge. But it's also important to say, okay, if you're going to do meth and poppers and Viagra at the same time.
Oh, my gosh.
Well,
no judgment there, but
no
be careful.
But yeah, really be careful because you can give yourself an aneurysm.
Yeah. So, I mean, so poppers can create a unsafe drop in blood pressure.
Right. That sounds right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then Crystal does the opposite, yeah?
Uh-huh.
So
it's a stimulant.
Yeah. So, yeah.
And
no
then,
good.
You know, people are doing this and then they could be involved in high risk behaviors, you know.
Absolutely.
Actually, yeah. the Viagra or ED drugs also can drop blood pressure.
So oh, really?
Yeah. That's originally the purpose that was intended for them. Mm. And then they found out.
And they're
that,
like, hey.
Right. So the combination of the Viagra and, let's say, poppers can cause that unsafe drop, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a quick question about clitorises and priapism. And maybe no one has the answer. That's okay.
Okay.
I'm looking around. I'm like, I don't know much about clitoris.
Oh.
That's all right. That's all right. Maybe rock and roll nurse notes. Okay. How would I know if I have an erect clitoris for more than 4 hours? Would it hurt, do you think?
I would think so.
Would it hurt?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not speaking from experience, obviously.
Yeah.
And clitorises are totally different from penises, so.
But they are fetally analogous.
They are analogous, yes. I would say
and
there is analogous.
Sometimes I have clitoral orgasms that are like, I feel like I have a penis right now. This is so awesome.
But thinking about what causes, what would be behind that, the physiology behind it, it means that probably your blood vessels are...
Oh, blocked in some way.
No, not necessarily. Well, maybe
were
maybe blocked. Yeah. Probably
maybe.
they opened up, you know, they became larger, they dilated to let all this blood in, and then they constricted.
Mm-hmm. And then the blood couldn't get back
and
out.
And the blood can't get out.
Mm, interesting.
So that's not, it's not a normal situation.
Oh,
and
okay.
I would expect it to cause pain after a while because your tissue is being asked to do stuff that it's not normally asked to do.
Right.
It's different for every different person, I'm sure. Maybe some people would get off in it and think it's great, but I would
right.
say
well, if it hurts
I would agree
in a bad
with
way,
Wikipedia
then.
That it right. is it
is
should
a
be considered
emergency.
A medical emergency.
even it's if not totally awesome. I mean,
even
you
if
know,
you
it's a totally awesome
even
medical
if
emergency,
you, like
you should
it,
go to the doctor.
It's even if you really enjoy it, it's not a good thing right. for your body and
yeah.
your parts. And if you want to keep them in good working condition, get something done about it.
And you know, I think Jorge is probably a good expert in the realm of good pain versus bad pain.
That's okay.
Do you want to talk about good pain versus bad pain?
Sure.
Because in BDSM there are masochists and a lot of people think, oh well, you must like pain all the time, but that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, I love that misconception. I'm not saying that it's a bad misconception.
We're not judging
if you're ignorant. No, just kidding.
No.
Actually, ignorant just means that you don't have knowledge.
Not, yeah.
So
not
it's not a judgment
okay.
on your lack of knowledge.
It's not like George W. Bush stupid.
We're not judging.
So bad pain, good pain. So I enjoy pain. I enjoy intense sensation.
Mm-hmm.
The pain is just a sensation, just like tickling, just like, you know, caressing. It's just a different type of sensation.
Well, there's nails on the back. There's
exactly.
spanking. There's, you
yeah.
know.
So I enjoy.
Gateway pain.
Yeah. So now I like to get, you know, I like to get pierced and hooked and suspended and flogged and all kinds of stuff.
And you also play with a single tail sometimes.
I do. I do. I love,
both
love throwing my
and
single
receiving.
Tail. Both. Yes. I'm a switch. And now here's the thing. Now, even though I love playing, I love getting a single tail to my back or getting needles put on my body, if I'm riding a horse and I fall off a horse, that's not good pain.
Right.
that's gonna hurt regardless.
You're
of...
You're not like in some sort of ecstatic,
I'm like
oh,
yeah, man, I broke my arm.
I fell off a horse. awesome.
Yeah, I have a concussion, dude. So, no, you know, so there's
like,
good
I'm
pain
so
and bad pain.
I have a concussion,
and right. our bodies respond to pain differently, whether we're...
the intention.
Yeah, intention is huge. Intention is big, and also if you're aroused or not.
Totally.
You know, if you're not aroused,
absolutely.
Your body will react to pain or intense sensation
completely differently. Well, what I've noticed is if I'm having an orgasm and someone's pinching my nipple during the orgasm, as soon as my orgasm is finished, then it's like, ow! Stop doing that! Whereas before I was like, oh my God, that's so amazing! You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
and it's amazing, like immediately how it changes. Like your
wow.
whole autonomic nervous system just completely interprets the sensation differently.
I gotta say, you're lucky. My nipples are not even wired.
Really?
No.
Oh, mine are completely connected.
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
Factory standard?
They did come. Although, honestly, I do hear that you can connect different areas of your body to your erogenous zones with the right amount of stimulation and patience.
Are we talking about transferring chi around your body?
Kind of.
Okay.
Kind of.
Interesting.
Only this is one of those techniques from Eve Minax, who's a professional dominatrix and sex educator. And basically what you do is if you can stimulate an erogenous zone that's like really part of your orgasmic pathway, like your penis or your clitoris or whatever really works for you, and the area that you want to build sensation in at the same time and connect erotically, you can do that. And she says that you can do that for any part of the body, even like the inside of your elbow or your armpit. She can actually have an orgasm from people licking her underarms.
Wow. You know what? That makes absolute sense. I know some people who really get off when you rub their bellies.
Really?
Yeah.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it's really about neural pathways, but you can call
exactly.
it chi.
Well, and you can really change and move around your neural pathways and have them reinforced by positive sensations.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, to me, it's different names for the same thing. You know, you can get medical or you can get, you know, historical. It's not like people, when they didn't have the medical words, they didn't know kind of what was going on.
Well, I wonder about that, because there seemed to be, like, it's not like they were doing kink forever, were they?
I mean, think we've been beating the hell out of each other for thousands of years.
I would say forever.
Consensually in a fun and happy way, do you mean?
Sure.
You know, I mean,
yeah,
we've certainly
absolutely.
Been abusing each other
absolutely.
For a long time.
I recall being a little kid and playing with candles. You know,
yeah,
and dripping wax
too.
On my fingers mm-hmm. And
totally
really enjoying
that.
The sensation of that. Mm-hmm. Or skipping, you know, I know this is really gross, but like picking up my scabs on my knees when I was a little kid. Or, you know, I mean, you know.
Right.
I mean, I'm not saying I had
totally.
A really interesting childhood, but I'm just saying there's something to be said.
I think you get socialized out of it, too, because I remember being in the bathtub and I had this thing where I would take the head of my penis and kind of turn it inside out. I don't know
right.
if there's a name
could.
For that.
Puppy
yeah,
you
I was, it was really
cut or uncut.
I am cut.
Okay.
Yeah. So you kind of pull it. I don't even know how to describe it exactly, but at the time I
so
it was like I'm making a duck, and then my mother came in and I wanted to show her, and she
was not.
She was really grossed out and really unhappy about it. And then it was, I kind of got
not
this message that, oh, well,
it's
maybe
not
I
okay to
be
talk about. Yeah.
It's not okay to talk about. Probably not okay to do.
Penis duck.
You know what's funny?
Death of the penis duck. Sad.
Yeah, it's true. I remember my, I'm going to totally out my brother, but when he was 2 years old, we have four brothers, so. When he was like 2 years old, you would catch him in the corner playing with his little wee-wee and his diaper. And very early on, you know, he was snapped out of that as well.
Right, because your parents will shame you because they want to protect you from people. But the other thing is like, then I think people get the message that it's not okay to masturbate. And then let's talk about the importance of masturbation.
I think it's very important to masturbate.
Right.
Particularly for your mental health.
Right.
In my opinion.
Yeah, and it's also like a really good way to know how you like to be touched and really get into your own pleasure.
Absolutely. You know, I've had sexual partners where I'll ask them, show me. And they're like, what? I'm like, I want to see what makes you feel good.
Right. Then I'm going to do it to you.
Exactly. Because I want to make you feel good later on.
Exactly.
But also being vocal about what you like. Mm-hmm. You know, once you learn what you like, you know, by exploring your own body, you can say, hey, guess what? Mm-hmm. You know, you can do this and that. You know, you can lick my nipples if you want. You might be wasting your time.
Oh,
you can twist here and there.
Totally.
You know, but.
Totally. I love that, though, about both being in a community where you can be really open about sex and also becoming a sex educator myself. Like, I've become like a laser pointer in being able to talk to my partners about testing, about what I like, what I don't like. And, you know, I can get the traffic cones and be like, yes, I like it over here. And I like it like that. And then first you do this and then you do that. And then I'm like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's really fun. Whereas, you know, when I was an adolescent, talking about sex was impossible. And having an orgasm was impossible. And you know what I mean? I didn't think I had one until I was like 20 during sex. You know?
Wow.
That's how it is sometimes for people.
But were you able to give yourself one at any point before that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I could do it with masturbation, but not with a partner until I was 20.
Oh,
except for I had a girlfriend in high school who made me come. You know what I mean?
Nice.
But like with a boy, it never happened because... You know, I didn't know how to play with my clitoris. Hello.
Well, clearly they didn't know how to play with your clitoris.
Well, you can either, you know, multitask and one person do it and the other person do something else. That's cool. But, you know, like, I think it's something like 10% of women haven't had orgasms yet. And then 75% of women, you know, can only orgasm with clitoral stimulation. And then only this, you know, remaining very small percentage of women actually come only from penetration. Like, who can have an orgasm from, you know, someone not playing with their clitoris? I mean, and of course, there's other women who can come from...
On command.
Yeah, on command, having their underarms licked, having their toes licked, having their, you know what I mean, some pretty awesome orgasms. But nonetheless, you know, you probably have to have some... either talent, skill, or practice with that sort of thing.
And be lucky.
Yeah, totally. But there's a lot of different ways to have an orgasm, and there's a lot of different kinds of orgasm.
Absolutely.
Even for men. And I think a lot of men think there's... Or I think men and women, I've found, think that there's only one kind of orgasm for men. A lot of people.
The sneeze.
And that's...
The ejaculatory
right.
Yeah,
coming,
that,
right.
That I don't think is really accurate. And that's something that I learned through masturbation, of course.
Right.
Oh, so you learned it on your own. I had to read a book and practice a lot.
Really?
Yeah. There's a really great book called The Multi-Orgasmic Male.
Oh, I've heard about that
it's
book.
It's a great book.
Yeah.
Yeah. I even practiced on how to come without touching myself.
Oh, neat.
Yeah. It only happened
awesome.
Once.
That's awesome. How do you do that?
It took a long time and a lot of frustration.
So you talked
and a lot
to
of
yourself?
Practice. You know what? It was...
you're coming without any stimulation at all,
right?
You're
right.
Just mentally stimulating yourself.
Yeah, I was stimulating myself
not only
in my head, but I was, you know, I was touching everywhere else and definitely feeling my body. And,
okay.
Feeling sexy and all that. But I was, and it's really interesting when you have an orgasm that it's not the sneeze.
Right.
I love that, by the way. How you call that?
Achoo! Oh, pardon me.
a non-ejaculatory. Orgasm, at least in my experience, is 10 times more powerful and more intense than if you just go ahead and just blow your load.
Right.
I can say that on the radio, right?
Please.
Blow your load.
As long as you mean it in a nice way.
I mean blow your load in a nice way.
Amen. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more with Jorge Vieto from the Stop AIDS Project about all sorts of fun, kinky, orgasmic, and safer sex. Also, we'll have Maxine Holloway of the Art Gallery Feminipotens talking about Art of Restraint. And we'll also have Andrew Sullivan, who worked on an open invitation, a real swingers party here at the Armory in San Francisco. Our token straight guy has been the rock and roll nurse.
Yeah, I'm still here.
This is Sexploration with Monica on FCC Free Radio.
You're listening to FFR.
Radio for the people, by the people.
This is Sexploration with Monica. I'm Monica. Tonight, a fun show. We're going to talk about some porn soon. We've got an open invitation with Andrew Sullivan. It's from a real swingers party in San Francisco. And Maxine Holloway, who is also a kink porn star. And she works at Feminipotens, which is the sex-positive feminist art gallery here in San Francisco. And they're doing a bondage event called The Art of Restraint. We're here now with Jorge Vieto. He's Leather Daddy Boy. He does a lot of public health, HIV, and hepatitis outreach. And you had the single tail at the bondage dinner and did a couple of performances for us.
That's right. That was a lot of fun. That was so much fun. I love the Supper Club.
It's really a place where you can be your authentic self and let your freak flag fly and have a fabulous dinner. And we're going to have another dinner coming up on May 6th with Jessica Kitten, and we'll have Ender Silence. She's going to tie them up as dolls. She'll have these two live girls tie them up as dolls, do some suspensions, a little bit of creepy darkness, doll Catholic girl skirts sort of action. And then we'll have some fire play with Francesca Gentili and her new partner Tim. We'll have a lot of, and we have a fashion show with hats and couture and maybe some lingerie, and so I think it's going to be a good one. Oh, and we also have the Lubari bondage dinner coming up June 24th with the world famous shibari rigger Lou Rubens, who, you know, did his own style of shibari, Lubari. And you do bondage as well. You were actually recommended to me as a bondage expert. That's how I first got his name.
Oh, I'm so flattered. It's definitely one of my major things.
Uh-huh.
And so is music, apparently.
Yes. Well, you know, music is
get that
is
band
a way
out
to...
of here. Who invited them?
Sorry.
It's a shared space. What can we say?
Exactly. Exactly. So let's talk a little bit more about hepatitis C and how you can prevent it. There are a lot of easy ways that are available here in San Francisco and on the internet.
Yeah, so during the break, we were talking about some ways to prevent hepatitis C.
Right.
Obviously, knowing your Hep C status is one of the most important things.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know your Hep C status, or if you don't know your partner's Hep C status, there are some things that you can do, and there are some products out there, actually, that you can buy that can help you reduce your possibility of acquiring or giving someone hepatitis C. And one of those products is Cavicide. Now, what I like about this particular product is that it's available at Mr. S here in San Francisco, mm-hmm. which is a local leather shop. I'm sure it's also available online.
Mm-hmm.
But the one thing that I really love about this product is that it comes in two forms. One form is a wipe. So it's great for wiping down your cross, your spanking bench, your car, you know, whatever you want to wipe down.
Any of your sex toys, the Maserati.
Right. And then they also have a spray bottle with Cavicide. Now, the one thing to keep in mind with this, it's not something that just works. You know, you can't
have to let it dry.
Yeah. Actually, you have to let your item soak for about 10 minutes.
Oh, you have to soak them.
Yeah, you have to.
It's leather.
And that's the thing. So one of the challenges we're finding with Cavicide is that it may over dry some of your leather items, like your floggers and your whips and your restraints and all those. You know, accoutrement that you spent
items.
A lot of money on.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
So there are ways that you can compensate for that. I mean, you can certainly condition your leather. One of the things that I like to do, especially with my single tails or with my whips, is that I have replacement crackers. So the cracker is a little thing at the end of the whip that makes that really
big
noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I ended up doing with my whips is I sewed a little loop at the end of the whip, and I buy twine in bulk.
Oh.
The white twine.
And that way you can have a new cracker every time.
Yeah. And, you know, and if I do open someone's back, I give them their cracker and say, here's your little partying gift. And I get to replace
it. To remember you by.
Right. And the great thing about that is that if you don't have Cavicide, or if you don't have access to something like that, that's another alternative that you can use to keep yourself safer.
Right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Cavicide is not really good for skin.
Yes.
So you need to protect yourself when you're using it.
Yeah, yeah. So contact dermatitis can be definitely one of those things that you can get from handling this stuff without gloves. So we certainly recommend wearing gloves.
What's contact dermatitis?
Well, it's very caustic to the skin, so it can actually mess up your skin, give you a rash or something. But it's just we have it in the hospital, and I always wear gloves whenever I'm using the wipes. always, all the time. I used to not do that, and I was okay. But if you look at the commercially available Cavicide that you have in the hospital, it says all over it, you know,
gloves,
don't use
gloves,
it.
Gloves,
yeah.
Gloves, gloves.
Don't use it on skin or any kind of tissue or any kind of human tissue.
Right.
I wanted to mention also, I know we're throwing out a lot of different names of cleaning agents out there. However, there's also a lot of information out there on the internet. So most cleaning agents and products have what they call an MSDS sheet, material safety data sheet.
Right.
That
yeah.
will go ahead and tell you what kind of precautions to use when using a particular product,
right.
how to use it, how long it lasts. Also, a lot of these products have a limited shelf life.
Oh, that's you mean they're only effective against this particular virus or whatever?
Yeah, well, limited shelf life as well, like how long they will stay good or active or good to actually do the
kill
job
the
that
virus.
They do.
Right.
So for a while there, we were using this chemical called four-way quaternary disinfectant, which was this stuff that we used to have to mix in water, and you know, and we were really excited about it because 5 milliliters of the stuff would basically make 1 gallon of cleaner.
Right.
However, it was only shelf stable for 6 months.
Oh. Well, so how could you? I mean, a gallon of cleaner is quite a lot.
Right. So most likely you're not going to go through a gallon of cleaner.
Right.
I mean, you could if you're sexually generous.
Which is a compliment, really. You're generous with your sexuality. Cool. Well, it's been wonderful having you on the show today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Let's talk how people can get involved with HIV and hepatitis outreach as Hepatitis Month is coming up with the month of May.
Yes, it is. So I'm going to go ahead and give you 2 website addresses, actually. Mm-hmm. And these are sort of like clearinghouses. So speaking of HIV, visit the Stop AIDS website, www.stopaids.org. We have a great resource section there as well. And also, if you want to know about more about the Hepatitis C Task Force, you can log on to www.hepcsf.org. Before I go, can I give one quick little plug? April 28th is Dining Out for Life. It is one of the Stop AIDS Project's biggest fundraisers. Hundreds of restaurants are participating all throughout the Bay Area. All you have to do is go into a participating restaurant, and 25% of your bill will automatically be donated to the Stop AIDS Project.
You can have a nice
project.
Evening and make a donation at the same time.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I'll be at Memphis Beniz, so come and enjoy some barbecue.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Jorge Vieto from the Stop AIDS Project. It's been great to have you on the show again. So Andrew Sullivan is here from an open invitation. In just a moment, we'll be talking to Maxine Holloway, talking about the art of restraint. This is FCC Free Radio, fccfreeradio.com. You can also listen to free podcasts at sexplorationwithmonica.com. This is FCC Free Radio, Sexploration with Monica. We're here with Andrew Sullivan. He is bringing us The Open Invitation, a real swingers party in San Francisco. This was it's kind of a different way of doing a porn because there was really real people, like real swingers at this party, and you're making a porn with it.
Yeah, no, it wasn't just that. It actually had stories behind it, and
it had
a plot.
Wow.
And it had 82 pages
Meaning.
Of script, right?
Right.
I mean, like, people saw this thing, they're like, what? You know? I mean, when you see an abstract
I'm gonna
of
have
porn,
to remember lines? Whoa.
No, it was a trip. Actually, India Summer walked in, and she said, she looked at me and she said, I haven't done a movie like this in 10 years.
Right.
You know? Because it was like story, plot, you know, great production. You know, the stars felt important.
I know, that's so nice. They felt like they had an acting career going on.
Yeah.
Right, which is important because people really like plot, as it turns out.
Well, they like context. I mean, plot can
be
bad.
Like, why are you having...
You know, plot can be like, you know, women with big tits screw short, bald men. You know? But
yeah,
this
that
had
is
a meaningful
plot, but this
morning
is a good
story
plot,
and plot.
Right, the difference between a bad plot. Yeah. So, Open Invitation is kind of a love story. It starts out with this, you know, happily married, incredibly hot couple, I must say.
Yeah.
And they kind of have this, you know, wistful moment at the beginning where they kind of have, you know, penis vagina kind of boring married person intercourse. He's like, oh, I didn't think you'd want to have sex because we had sex on Tuesday, you know,
right,
sort of
right,
thing.
Right, right,
and
right.
She's like, yeah, we could. And then after she's like, because, you know, she didn't look like she had an orgasm. And then they get this invitation in the mail. Or no, wait. they run into this other frisky couple first.
That's right.
Okay. So basically it starts
off
with
like... I was watching
it
for the plot, ladies and gentlemen.
That's right. That's right. There's so much going on. Even Monica got confused here.
Right.
The hot sex
but
totally
the whole thing
just
is an invitation. Yeah. Right.
I mean, you know, the idea was like, you know, it kind of came out of this experience of seeing all of many people I know who are wonderful people and who have long marriages and are loving people. Seeing them in bad marriages.
Right.
And, you know...
Or even a good marriage, but just not hot sex in the marriage. Because if you live with someone, for some reason, that can tend to diminish your need to rip off their clothes.
That's a problem, right?
What is going on with that?
I mean, on the long-term basis, like, you know... That's right. You know, yeah, take it off and get down to business. And that fixes all the other problems, like who's taking out the garbage tonight?
Yeah, exactly.
You're like, don't take out the fucking garbage. We're going to have sex.
Right, totally.
That problem's solved, right?
Right,
And so, I mean, that was kind of the beginning of the movie was, you know, this idea of that, you know, there is a couple in love, and that's
right.
That's already a diversion from the standard porn plot, which is, you know, there's a problematic situation and somehow like radical sex fixes it. And this is like there is actually love there. They don't know how to talk about it. They don't know really what to do. And
right.
And they want something, but they don't even know where to begin the conversation.
Right.
And then we switch to, you know, the sort of, you know, foil to that couple who walks in the door and can't even make it to the bed, right? The scene ends before
right.
they make it to the bed,
totally,
right?
And totally,
so,
yeah,
you
they
know,
don't
the bed
make it
is
to
certainly
the bed.
Superb. That's for sleeping. You know, it's a rug on the floor.
Right, totally. And they're crawling around, and she's doing this, and he's doing that, and they're like, hey, oh, wait, let me get my toy bag.
That's right.
And then it gets on.
That's
yeah,
right.
Totally.
That's right.
So they meet this other couple in a restaurant and have this great flirtation. Oh, and see them, catch them making out on the way to the bathroom.
Right. You've watched the film.
I was watching it. I nearly
she
was
fast forwarded to the plot scene. The dialogue.
I was looking for my friends in the background. Mm-hmm. I must admit that was the really fun part at the end.
Yeah.
The big orgy scene. Yeah. I'm like, oh look, there's my friend. Oh wait, look over there. Oh, that's her. You know what I mean?
Someone
really
you
fun.
Know is in this film.
I
must say that
I'm
if you
in
live
the
in
background.
San Francisco,
yeah.
someone you know is in this film.
I am in the background in that film.
Yeah.
I
you
was
are.
At that party, yeah.
You were at the top?
Oh, yeah.
Oh!
Oh, yeah.
Oh!
Totally. That
okay.
was a fun party. Are
all
you
right.
kidding?
All right, good.
I mean,
good.
You get to hang out, have some snacks, drink some wine, make out with your friends, watch some porn stars, get it on.
Yeah, as
those
someone say,
best parties
you know,
ever.
I came for the appetizers, I stayed for the blowjob.
Right, exactly. And I, as I said to Peter, I was like, you know, if I had a penis, I would probably want a blowjob right now, too.
All right. Leaves us wondering.
Yeah, right. Good right. good luck with
yeah.
that. So tell me more about Open Invitation. It kind of becomes an open invitation to the viewer to open up their own marriage and experiment with sexual freedom. I mean,
right.
that's right in the name.
Right. I mean, the idea was, I mean, you know, there's, you know, multiple meanings to the title, right?
Right.
I mean, there's, the, you know, it's an open invitation, but, you know, it's an open to be open. It is out there for everybody. And part of the idea was, there are always invitations to adventure unraveling before you. You might not be aware of them. And that's part of what's going on with this couple is that they're locked in an emotional box. And they don't see these opportunities. And it's only when they are ready to see them that they actually present themselves and they take advantage of them, right?
Right.
So, I mean, one of the things is that, you know, you do have to change your mindset to actually, you know, be aware of and it, let alone take advantage of all these things that are happening before us, you know.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, so, you know, that was kind of like the basic driver behind the title was that And where that leads is, I think, different for every couple.
Right.
Right? I mean, some of them...
Communication is key.
You know, as Philippe Lewis once said in one of these panels we were doing, he said, just talking about it can be enough for some couples.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
totally.
Go home and talk about it.
Yeah.
And
oh,
that
no,
can lead to, like,
better
hot
than talking
sex
about,
and
yeah,
a connection.
I could be doing this to you while you're doing something else to her and just thinking about it and, you know?
Yeah. 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 And part of that was also, I mean, you know, it's tied to... this idea that it's so easy to get into ruts and into you know, to have particularly like modern life. It's like these
your daily obligations,
dual income. Yeah. Everybody's working.
Everyone's working,
you know,
so hard, and they don't make time for pleasure. And
mortgage the city. It's like,
yeah,
man,
you're
mortgage all this stuff.
Parking
it's like this
tickets,
is rat race happening, and you forget
totally.
About the basics of the emotional connection that really fuel, you know, adventure in life
and your passion.
And passion. And you know, and this is kind of what we wanted to focus on in the film. It's like a lot of people that I see around me are looking at the relationship as something that holds them back.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, it's like, God, man, this right. thing is holding me back from adventure. It's holding me
right.
back from freedom.
Oh.
And not as a catalyst and a springboard towards these things.
Where you
and,
could create a safe space for each other that's
right.
to
that's
experience
right.
freedom.
That's right.
So by that, just being present with them, like saying, okay, I'm willing for you to experience pleasure, and then I'm not going to break up with you. Hey.
That's right. That's right. But that requires an incredible foundation of
trust.
Right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, major
communication.
Trust, a lot of emotional maturity.
Yeah.
And, you
it's
know.
It's not easy.
There's, it's, okay, well, that's
but
another
so
whole topic. If you want to go there, it's not easy is a big, you know, big thing.
Well, let's go there. Because, I mean, I think it's important. I mean, what do you learn when you're opening up your relationship?
As I told friends of mine who were at one point, you know, they were getting married and they're kind of, you know, going into, and this you know, happens for any couple who, you know, wants to think of like having kids or something like that. I mm-hmm. said, wow, if you have any cracks in your foundation, this thing will stress those cracks.
Right.
And so you just have to be aware that that's going to happen and that your foundation can support the emotional weight that this situation brings.
Right.
And I think opening up your relationship really does that. If there are,
it's crack investigation.
That's right. It will expose those cracks and it will rip them open and it will bring them out. As I said, you know, it unleashes the emotions that we have a legal system to protect people from killing one another for. I mean, jealousy. I mean, these are
right.
things that really drive at the core of what makes you an animal. And it, mm-hmm. I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people underestimate when they go there is that. This is not a vehicle for, you know, the timid or for simple, you know, you don't flirt. I think you don't flirt with this. You have to come to it from a position of extreme strength. And even then,
right.
you know, you can get knocked on your ass
yeah,
very quickly. And
totally.
You have to be in a situation where that's okay.
Right.
And you know when to pull back mm-hmm. and say we need to stop. We need to have a pause. We need to evaluate. And
you can be at a sex party and be like, listen, we need to go talk right now. I'm sorry, baby.
But it
I don't
want like,
to interrupt, but I got to go talk to you right now.
It sounds like it's kind of a healing process. And a lot of healing processes, you have to kind of rip wounds open to get the healing started. If you just leave them festering, they're going to fester and get worse. If that makes any sense, I'm a nurse. I'm the rock and roll nurse,
mm-hmm.
so I'm. That's why I'm putting in medical terms
rock
here,
med?
I guess.
All right. No. That's right. That's right. I mean, it is. I would say almost it's you know, it's like trauma in a way where it's unlike a medical experience where you can take a pill to, you know, deal with this ailment.
Oh,
it's all of a sudden you walk in and you're bleeding profusely and somebody's got to actually deal with this. And you're
right.
not prepared for those experiences. Mm-hmm. There's nothing. And this is, I think, the interesting thing is you have in sort of the normal, you know, idea of a relationship and the progression of that relationship, you have these basic stages that are, you know, assumed. It's like we go out, we're dating, and all of a sudden, hey, we might actually, you know, see each other really regularly now. And then
and
all
now
of a sudden,
monogamous.
We're moving in with one another, mm-hmm. and maybe we share bank accounts, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden, we might, you know, share rent or share a mortgage. And, you know, like there's this progression that happens. And in this environment, there isn't, you know, a really clear model for anyone to follow to say, hey, what level of intimacy are you willing to embrace as a couple with another party?
Right.
Right.
Like, are you willing to just have sex? Are you just skimming over the surface of their bodies? Or are you willing to drop into a relationship? And what does that look like and mean? Like,
and
is it just your friend? Is it, could you fall in love with that other person? Do you have to try to stop yourself from falling in love?
That's right. And what do you say if that happens?
Right.
How integrated are they in your life as a couple? not just your life as a, you know, an individual having a relationship with that person, but them actually being drawn into your life as a couple. I mean, these are really complex issues that come up, and there's no simple roadmap. I mean, you got Dossie out there, and she's on one extreme, which is kind of like
Easton,
it's all a
slut.
Community, right? You know, embrace this, and they're part of your life, and you know, if they fall down, you run to rub their heal them, right? And then there are other extremes of that where it is just a more visceral thing.
Right.
You know,
well,
that
there's
happens.
Like a swinger sort of vibe. I mean, there's kind of the we only have sex with other people when we're at a party, or we only have sex with other people when we're both there. I mean, there's different levels of safety for every couple. And I think that's really healthy, you know? I mean, Dossie's kind of a proponent of the non-hierarchical, free-flowing, you know, every relationship find its own level kind of thing. But she's also using that as a model for spiritual growth. I mean, mm-hmm. she's like her highest relationship isn't a relationship that lasts forever. It's the one that, you know, creates the most spiritual growth for her. So she's just working. But many people say, you know, I have kids, you know, I want to pick one person, be with that person forever. And then we can, you know, maybe do other things on the side. But here's what makes me feel safe. And here's what makes me feel not safe.
I think that one thing when in the progression that you were describing before, where it's kind of more like the typical atomic family direction, where you couple and meet and sharing bank accounts and getting married and having kids, blah 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 blah, that it becomes I don't know, it becomes more risky to be honest in a lot of people's minds, which is kind of twisted.
Right. I see what you're saying,
but. Because you've got all these ties with this person, and you feel like you have to stay with this person, you have responsibilities, and et cetera, then when things come up where it's going to cause conflict,
you have feelings,
sometimes maybe. You tend to gloss over that. I see that as a number one problem where all of a sudden a certain level of dishonesty and anti-communication starts creeping in, and that is just sheer poison. Because once it gets in, it's a slippery slope. It just goes on and on and on, and
you're
pretty
trying
soon,
to clean up and webbing the web of lies, et cetera, that you're trying to create.
Do you mean before or after opening?
Before opening,
well, I think being honest about having an open relationship, like non-consensual, non-monogamy, otherwise known as cheating.
Yeah.
You know, you have feelings. Boy, I'm attracted to that other person. It's making me feel excited and special again for the first time. What does that mean for my primary relationship?
Right. And then all of a sudden, because there's been this basis of, well, I have to lie to protect that primary relationship, then that becomes part of the lie that snowballs. Rather than, you know, a healthy open relationship, which would start with saying something that it might not be well taken, like maybe we should open things up.
Mean
you know,
you don't
that's
love
right.
me.
Yeah, I know, right? Exactly.
I think you're gonna leave me, and
yeah,
that's right. That's
I know
right.
It's awful. And if she's prettier than you, even if you're like, boy, you're hot. And I'm so glad that you brought home a hot chick.
It's a risk.
She's French.
Yeah. I can't understand what you're saying.
She has that perfect mouth.
Yeah. It can be a major, major risk. And even if it's...
But it's growing pains. It really is. And it's only a risk if you actually break up. If you can stick to it and be like, I am in this relationship with you and we are going to work it out and I trust you to not be hurting my feelings even though I am hurting right now and I'm not going to blame my feelings on you. I'm going to know that they're just my feelings and they're based on my own unique emotional matrix, right? Like your own experiences. Like it's not your partner's fault that you're feeling jealous. Maybe it was because of something your partner did, but your partner wasn't doing that to make you feel jealous. Your partner was probably just following their pleasure and their own, you know, turn on. Like, they're like, oh, that person's cute. Oh, awesome. Maybe I can bring them home.
There's
She's
a,
French.
There's
That's
a great,
awesome.
Great example of I think, what it takes to make something like this work in terms of the perspective that you have to have. And a friend of mine has been in an open relationship for 15 years. And even then, you know, like deep into their openness... his wife wasn't being honest, and he caught her.
Right,
and he you know called us on the phone as they were both driving on a trip, and he said, "My wife was being a lying, cheating bitch," And he started laughing hysterically.
Oh, he did?
Right.
He's
and
laughing.
I thought, like,
that
was
good
that,
laughing.
You know, it, basically, he was able to understand why she would do that without putting the entire relationship at jeopardy. Hmm. And I think that's part of the thing that brings people, that builds the walls. Like, when the stakes are that high, and I think this is what you're getting to. It's like, uh-huh. we've built up an empire together.
Right.
We've got all this stuff. You know, and right. we worked so hard to build it.
Yeah,
and you know, oh my God,
and your history,
to
your
talk
love
about
for each
anything
other.
that might you know imply a threat to that entire environment, that's taboo,
right?
So that builds another wall around the whole situation. And what this guy was displaying is like, you know what? There are no walls. Mm-hmm. I understand you as a human being. Right, I understand you. You are not doing this maliciously. You are growing and you are figuring this out, and it's part of a process that I'm committed to working with you on. And yeah. I think that's a very different perspective than I'm going to hold you at task for any mistake you might make or any transgression you might make. That raises the stakes. So it's like, shit.
Right.
You know?
Then you can't screw up because you're putting the relationship in jeopardy. All the like. It's kind of like the sin model. Like, you can't be forgiven.
That's
right. You
know,
you can't move forward because, I mean, if what you want is for someone to, like, if you want a stable relationship, then you just have to agree that you're not going to break up with them even when you think it's their fault for screwing up, you know?
And I think that's what, you know, I often think of, like, my grandmother and the sort of the sense of unconditional love that she had for us. You know, I mean, we could do no wrong at the end of the day. You
You're
know,
she
could be mad and angry, but I mean, there was always, she always embraced us. And I think that is the same kind of model that I try to bring into this, which is you have to have an extremely broad understanding of the scope of human desire, human behavior when you go here, because it will come out. You are basically opening up Pandora's box and saying it's all going to come out. And all of these things,
all of your feelings and insecurities.
And behavior and desires,
you
know, and parts of a personality that you may never have seen in your partner of 20 years or 15 years all of a sudden come out. And the sense is like, who? Whoa. I haven't. I never
Baby,
thought
I didn't
you
know
would.
You'd like
or you
double
want
penetration.
That's right. Exactly. Things like
and she's
that.
She's like, I didn't either. Or she's like, I didn't either. Whatever it is, right?
How could I have never known with just one?
Right, exactly. Who knew it was an option before that? Well, you can just try anything. But you would want to maybe communicate about it first. Just check in.
Yeah, the communication is key. My mother was a swinger in the 70s because it was the thing to do.
Who was it?
Yeah.
That is so
exactly.
Awesome.
But she had a partner who wasn't really into it. And she would just kind of shame him into going along with it, even though he didn't really... what are you, some kind of square or something? You know, this is all good, and you can have whoever you want. And he didn't want anyone else. And that caused
That's
a real
really
serious rift between them. I think it didn't end up being open, actually, even though they called it open. Just because you're having sex with other people doesn't make it an open relationship. If that, you know, I think openness goes a lot deeper when it's real. Maybe I haven't seen your film, but I'm guessing
really
that the film gets into that territory.
And there is the hottest girl on girl scene. Seriously, that you know, I don't remember the names of the two actresses.
Lorelai in India.
Yeah. Okay.
The suicide blonde and the brunette. Yeah.
So basically, what happens is they've been flirting and they had this whole exchange at the restaurant, and then one of them is a photographer, and then they like come. One of them shows up the other one's work and like, oh, I didn't like, there's all this like zoom, zoom, zoom sexual energy just flying through the air. And you're like, both they're really cute and they really like each other. And then they have like really authentic, like you can tell that they are having a good time.
Yeah, the set was very quiet.
I'm sure the energy in the room was just ridiculous.
And, you know, part of what that was about, why that seems important, right, is that the first when they meet, it's a Bacchanalian feast at this restaurant, and there's wine flowing, and it's sort of like anybody can imagine that situation of losing inhibition right then. But it's followed by a sober scene where she's a lawyer, right? So it's, and that was it's like that embodies like an incredibly conscious social decision within the context and framework of all of these rules that govern our lives. And she is now making an active choice,
sober,
to go there with this woman, right? And that's why we wanted to have that contrast in the scenes where the opening happens, You need a little lubrication to kind of let it happen. But then she actually makes a conscious decision to continue to go there and then goes back to her husband and says, look, this just happened to me.
And it was hot. So awesome.
That's right. And he embraces that. See, that's part of what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You have to be together as a couple going there. And I think that's, that, you know, first of all, there's a huge gap between saying, yeah, let's explore, you know, with other people. And then you get into it. And the other person, and often I think one partner might be more, you know, successful or vigorous or out there and aggressive, and they're moving there.
Well,
and
one
it's
of them's
easier.
The girl, and it's easier.
It's very easy. I mean, look, you know, the guys go out there and you say, "Hey, I'm a married guy," and they go, "What, you freak?"
Yeah.
You know, and the women out there like, "I'm a married woman," like, right on.
Hey.
And so the whole, like, there's this huge market of single guys who want to have sex with married women.
Right.
The converse isn't
it's
the same.
Different,
So you can often have these imbalances in
both. That's why the unicorn is so important.
Mm.
You know what unicorns are? Single women at sex parties.
Oh, that's of course, right.
It's the mythical beast.
No,
you don't know
right.
if it really
that's
exists.
Right. That's
but
right.
It's very special. Everyone wants it.
Yeah, well, at Club Kiss, it's like they're everywhere. So it's
I know. It's a very unicorn-friendly zone
right,
there.
Exactly.
But, of course, unicorns get in free. All single, you know, if you have a, girls get in free at Club Kiss. It's true.
It's a
fun party.
It is. It's a very fun party.
And you actually did an open invitation with Club Kiss, with Club Kiss Swingers and Chris and Sarah Kiss.
Yeah.
Making out on the couch there.
Yeah. That was the release party, the West Coast release party there, because we wanted to say the film is about, I mean, part of the film is also showcasing the cultural drivers in the community that do this. So it's not just it's a docudrama. There's a drama in the beginning, but the end of it is all about saying, hey, this is a real party, these are real people, and these are the personalities in San Francisco that have parties, that have clubs, that have venues and events, and here's their contact information, essentially.
Totally.
Right? And so we wanted to have the release party in a venue where we could draw people in who otherwise would never show up, you know, at a sex club. They could say, I'm going there for a talk. Right?
Yes.
And they're in the environment, and they can look around, and all of a sudden, what was really cool, they actually, Sarah and Chris both said that was like the most successful evening they've ever had. And I did one in New York with One Leg Up in New York, and the same thing happened. And that's that in the club, you have all these people that come there with this like very, there's like an intensity when you walk in the room. I'm like, you know, people think, it's got to count.
Have sex
like,
here.
We got babysitters. I'm paying $150. You know, it's got to count, right? I mean, this has got to count. And they come in there with this. You know, it's a pretty charged environment. And all of a sudden, you're having a conversation that's not about sex. It's about relationships. It's about communication and dialogue. And after the panel ends, people are in these groups talking.
Right. Already.
And that is hot.
Right.
Right. That's hot.
Discourse.
Because then all of a sudden, you've got a connection with people that's much deeper and intimate than you otherwise would on the dance floor going, yeah, you know, which can happen. It's like, I like you. You like me. You know, and there's just something else going on there.
Not that there's anything wrong with that, but.
No. That's right. There's a place and role for that. But
totally.
It definitely speaks to the fact that when there's a connection and there's intimacy, it's much hotter.
And that's that relationship that develops between these two couples and Lorelai and
India.
Exactly. You know, they actually like, you can tell they really like each other, and they're like, wow, I'm really flirting with this idea in a conscious way. This scene is amazing. It's really beautiful. I mean, because I think one of the things that is missing for me from porn is female pleasure and like really seeing like women being like, oh my God, this is so awesome, right?
Yeah.
Like I see that they're maybe they could be feeling good what they're happening or that they're just really professionals. Do you know what I mean? That they're
exactly.
able to remain okay in sexual adversity.
Yeah, well, I mean, the first scene, another contrast in the first scene is, you know, this very missionary kind of like Catholic guilt sex scene.
Right.
Like, oh God. And then it shifts
away
over.
And she's like,
no, you know, we did it. And then Lorelai and Mickey Maude, where Lorelai reaches over and grabs the Hitachi wand
That's
in
right.
the middle of the. So it's
yeah,
like, it's about
like,
her and
this.
Her pleasure in
and
that
he's
whole
like,
thing.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. I want that.
I want you to have more.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's butt play and there's all that stuff. So, I mean,
totally.
We really wanted to show the contrast between the average. You know, and it's
not that there's anything wrong.
It's not,
with
no.
Penis
it's not that
missionary.
Unhot. It's not that unhot. You
no,
know,
they,
but it's just in contrast to somebody that's really open to exploring their
Explosive.
Bodies and exactly. You start to see the contrast of oh, this is what it could be like.
Right. Exactly.
And that's why you have the scene after where they have their hot sex scene, where James and India finally have their hot sex scene, is after the apartment scene where they finally start talking to one another in India, or Lorelai's like, well, what are your fantasies?
Right.
Do you talk about this stuff? And James is kind of uncomfortable. He's like, oh, geez, well, you know, not about that. We talk about it, but not about like what how I fantasize about my wife, you know?
Right.
And she doesn't, you know, like, well, do I like to do X and Y and Z? And so that's when they first begin their conversation there. That environment opens up their dialogue, and it's after that that they finally have great sex, and he straps her up with a blindfold.
That's right.
Right? He lets it go a little bit,
yeah,
right? He starts
totally.
To get a little, you know, his own desires come out. And yeah, anyway, there's a story behind that too. I mean, which is the first those scenes were shot on the same day, actually. And the first scene we actually shot like six times because we couldn't get James in India to not have great sex.
Oh, hilarious. That
we had to keep stopping going, no,
like, dude,
don't flip her over and slap
much.
Her ass. You know, that's not what we're looking for here.
Hilarious.
They didn't know how not to escalate was the problem.
No, of course. Right? Of course. That's hilarious. Oh, funny. So let's talk a little bit more about this, you know, open invitation to people to experiment with sexual freedom in a safe space. How, you know, what are the first steps for a couple who's thinking about something like this? Besides watching the movie with their partner.
Yeah, that's a good first step. There's a serious gut check, I think, that happens when you're going here. And there has to be some, I think there's probably always someone in the relationship that takes the first step to bring it out.
Mm-hmm.
You
to
know?
Bring up
and
the conversation.
Yeah, there's somebody who's like, you know. And I think what's, to me, is important is, to again, get back to that first point of an understanding that our relationship is the base for adventure in our life.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about various ways to use our relationship as a base for adventure together. And we go there together. And this is all about supporting one another in our own personal growth path. And I think when you begin to frame it in a context like that, it's less threatening. And so I would always say the first step is making sure that's true. Because if it's not really true, then you're probably doing it for reasons that might stress that relationship in a very serious way.
Mm.
And so I would start there. It's like, are you really there? And I do see a lot of people here who are not going there for the right reasons. And in my mind, it's like, you don't have the base to survive some of the stresses there. And it's kind of, there's a tenuous thing. And so their relationship, you know, this, I don't really like the idea of the primary and secondary terms, because it implies a sort of connection between the two in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is a certain, for me, I don't like that. I know that there are plenty of people out there who have, you know,
that
triads and other relationships where there's incredible equality among all of the partners. And that's a whole different level, right? So that's one thing. It's like, what are we really interested in? And that will change over time, right? I mean, you may start out with swinging because I'll be there. We'll do it, but I want to be there in the same room. I want to watch it. I want to see it all.
Totally.
Right? And I'm taking notes, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, you know, you can play in different rooms. I trust you enough, but we're going to come back, and then we come and leave together. And, you know,
right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, it's like, well, maybe you can go out on your own. I think there's always a sense of, you know, you take a step.
Safety.
You take a step and you come back and you check in.
Right.
And if somebody's not feeling comfortable, there's a pause button that's hit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always the pause button. And I think one of the things is also communicating to anyone you're engaging with. And this is something I personally am learning. It's like communicating to those people that you're engaging with is also really important about where you are in that process.
Right.
Because, you know, you can easily use a word like intimacy. That means different things to different people.
You really
what
have
what
to
it
define
is in your head is very different from what it is in somebody else's head. And all of a sudden they're saying, well, you said intimacy, and that's not intimacy. Well, it is to me.
Right.
And you have, you know, so.
Or you can fall in love, or you can make out, or you can. What does monogamy mean? You know, I don't want you flirting with other people. I don't want you having, you know, penis vagina intercourse. Is butt sex okay? Is that monogamy? Can you have monogamous outside partner butt sex?
Only in San Francisco.
Right.
I think another thing that's important is that a sense of being judgmental has to leave the room.
Judging your partner for their desires?
Yeah,
sure.
Or, you know, this. I go back to the example with my mother where she was making a judgment for this against her partner because he wasn't on the same level as her. And I think it's sometimes easy to do that, to make it this weird competitive thing. But it's really, really poisonous to go there.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
There has to be mutual respect.
Open and
that
respectful
has to be, and that should be expressed by no judgments.
Yeah.
That we're talking and we're not going to put each other down and we're not going to try to shame each other.
Right. Well, let's talk about the party, because you guys are doing another open invitation in Barcelona.
Yes.
And you're going to have a party like this swingers party in Barcelona and Barcelona is a fun town. I can only imagine what this party is going to be like. Whoo! Yeah. That's right.
Barcelona.
Is it warm in here? Hey.
You got to say it, Barcelona.
Barcelona. Yeah. So tell us about that.
Well, the concept behind Open is to take the film to different major cities around the world and
so awesome.
Expose the community in those cities. So these are the people in Barcelona who are making this experience possible,
right,
in this city. And so that's one key part of it. The other key part of it is it's not just about swingers, really. The first one was more about swingers, but it was also about, you know, the spectrum. There is openness
happening
there. And
you just have that search tag. That's cool.
Oh, my God. I never thought of the SEO implications of that. Yeah. And but what the series is really about is taking everyday experiences that can be a catalyst for a transformation.
Right.
So the next script is about food and language.
Oh, exciting.
Because Barcelona is a food-crazy
totally.
Food-crazy city.
Sensation.
Yeah, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a very sensual town.
Totally.
And language in Catalan. Yeah. And so there's a lot of talking dirty in a foreign language that begins
awesome.
So it's like, well, I'm saying it in Spanish or I'm saying it in Catalan. It's not right. really me in English saying
okay.
it. So, you know, you can kind of provide a vehicle for, you know, exploring a certain part of your personality
that,
you know, you wouldn't otherwise explore.
Totally.
And it sounds hot,
yeah.
right, at the same time.
Exactly.
So language, and so the third one is about dance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about incorporating, there's a great bondage scene in the second one, too, with the relationship between tying up, you know, fowl and tying up people and the relationship that you have
and
to food and sex and all
awesome.
Of these. Yeah, exactly. You know, aphrodisiac elements. So it's a
nice.
It's a really nice script, actually. And the third one deals with dance as a catalyst. And, you know, the character walks in, and I'm not sure where this one will be. It'll be L.A. or New York. Happens to go to a dance class and a private lesson and get there early and sees the teacher. It's sort of like a tango.
I was wondering if it was going to be the
flamenco
tango.
Blend,
yeah,
right?
No,
where
course.
You know you hear the
that's perfect, yeah, and the
and the clapping sounds as the camera rolls in are actually slaps on the woman's face. They're having a very aggressive
dance,
right? And so she's exposed to this and doesn't know whether she wants to go to the lesson.
Right.
And that becomes the first framing of an everyday experience like that can actually become, you know, a channel for self-exploration and adventure and risk.
Right.
You know, that has all these rewards at the end of the film.
Yeah.
So it's
exploration.
Moving around the world and using these everyday experiences.
Yeah.
Sexploration.
Well, indeed.
If you didn't have that already.
You can borrow it if you want to give me credit for it. You go right ahead.
Okay.
But yeah, I think that's really exciting because it really, I mean, not only are you taking this and making it a real thing in real parties for real couples to explore while you're making the movie, but also as people watch it, it really creates a conversation.
Yeah,
that is so fun. So people can, you have it up on privatelifestyle.com. Is there a trailer there that people can
watch? Yeah, there's a trailer there.
Sweet. Yeah, it's a great film. And you can look for me in the background.
And there's Monica somewhere.
Yeah, no, I'm back there. I'm wearing
I'm going to go home
dress.
Tonight.
That's right. Yeah, you can go ahead with your, in the big orgy scene, look
That's
for me
right.
in the background.
That's right. Okay, good.
I'm wearing a mask, but you can probably tell it's
All
me.
Right. All
so.
Right.
Well, Andrew, it's been so great having you on the show.
See you again.
Yeah, absolutely. So in just a moment, we'll talk to Maxine Holloway from The Art of Restraint and Femina Potens. This is Sexploration with Monica. And you can fuck her gently. It's so true. So true. This is Sexploration with Monica. You can, you know, in any way that you could possibly do it, you can do it that way. And we would like to talk about the benefits and risks of each. That's what sexploring is all about. And we've been talking about a lot of fun things. And I've been telling you about I'm Maxine Holloway from Feminipotence and the upcoming Art of Restraint. Welcome.
Yes. Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for jetting on over here.
Yeah.
So the Art of Restraint is a bondage performance, but it's at the Sex Positive Feminist Art Gallery, Feminipotence. So tell me about the intersection of art and bondage.
Yeah. Well, it's a whole evening of intersection of art and bondage. We have
intersection. Sorry.
It's all right. Bring the puns. I'm ready. Yeah, it's a really lovely, decadent, erotic, creative event that showcases some of the country's most wonderful and talented bondage performers.
Right. And bondage is not easy.
No, bondage is not easy at all. Someone asked me yesterday on webcam, they're like, oh, well, what do you do? You just like, kind of just get tied up. Like, you don't really have to do anything,
right?
Oh,
as a bottom? No, you'd have to know what you're doing to be a rope bottom. That
like,
is for sure.
Thanks.
Well, clearly they don't know.
Exactly.
They don't know what
they're
doing.
Give me some rope. Let me tie you up and see how you feel about it. but yeah, and for this event, we really encourage our performers to get incredibly creative and layered, combining music and performance with the bondage.
Right.
That's where the whole art and performance comes in. So
yeah.
The theme for this spring's Art of Restraint, which is on April 30th, is transformation and rebirth.
Exciting.
Yeah. So we have the likes of Madison Young, who is the owner and wonderful director of
also known as
Art Gallery.
Madison Bound. She's
yes.
a kink porn star.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's a world-renowned
amazing.
Bondage performer,
yeah.
porn performer,
just the smell
director.
Of rope turns her on.
Yeah.
She's just really amazing.
Yeah. So her and her partner James are going to be performing, and I'm really excited because this is their first performance since having the newborn, Emma.
Aww.
So we're really excited to see them getting together. They always just have really deep, breathtaking
scenes.
Performances.
I bet.
Scenes, yeah. So it's really cool to see them perform as a couple.
And then, are you going to get tied up?
I am.
I thought so.
Excitement. I'm performing with Twisted Monk.
Oh, cool.
Who I'm really excited to see again. We did a small rope performance on the upper floor a few months ago. That's when we first met. It was like, hello, nice to meet you. May I tie you up? Oh, sure.
Yeah, sure.
And I was like, yeah, I'll just be like his warm up to the big event that he's doing with Jackhammer in a little while. Like, hour and a half later, I'm hanging from the ceiling. It was lovely.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. So we have a really nice, we're planning on doing something kind of different than last time, kind of really slow and sensual. He's going to be doing a blindfolded rigging, actually.
Oh, wow. So you'll be blindfolded
no,
or he's going to be
going
blindfolded?
To be blindfolded.
Wow. Well, it is
which
all
blows my mind.
Muscle
I don't
memory.
Even understand how that's possible. I've seen it done before, and I know it's possible.
Yeah. Rain DeGray actually can do it.
Yeah.
And she did a blindfolded self-suspension, actually.
Wow.
But she says it's actually kind of easier because she actually uses muscle memory to tie the knots anyway. It's not so much about what she sees, although I'm sure that an extra amount of cautiousness is needed. You know, you might want to put a mat down the first time you did a suspension like that.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, and like Monk and I have talked about, he's like, I'm going to need a lot of nonverbal communication from you, which I think is cool because then that's going to be really kind of connecting us as performers. And
oh, cool.
We're going to really have to do a lot of body communication.
Hey.
Yeah.
So tell us how we can get tickets, how we can find it on the web.
The Art of Restraint, the most direct way to get tickets, if you go to feminipotence.org, and that's feminipotence.org. That's the gallery's website. There is a front page, scroll down about halfway through, there is a little description about what's going to be going on that night and the performers, and there is a brown paper ticket link. And you're lucky to be knowing this now. If you buy your tickets before midnight tonight, we're running a special. Tickets are usually $75, but you can purchase them for $40 if you enter the promo code Knotty, Knotty.
Excellent. Maxine Holloway of Feminipotence, the feminist art gallery, and the Art of Restraint. You can find out more at feminipotence.org. That's feminipotence.org. My token straight guy has been the rock and roll nurse of Backspins. This is Sexploration with Monica.